It's Week in Review, where we try to make sense of the week's events. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke with Joni Balter, the host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, former Republican Party Chair Chris Vance, and former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. Welcome back to all of you.
Thank you.
To be here.
Welcome to you.
Well, it's been kind of a placid race for mayor up until this week. One issue has prompted some harsh rhetoric from candidates Jenny Durkin and Carrie Moon. Moon says that real estate speculation is driving up housing costs and reducing affordability. She wants to implement targeted taxes to deter corporate and non-resident real estate speculation. Carrie Moon said to The Stranger in April, this flow of Chinese money is looking for the next housing market, and it appears that Seattle and California cities are emerging targets. And now Jenny Durkin is calling this an anti-Chinese buyer tax and says, quote, we cannot go there, particularly in the age of Trump. In a statement, Carrie Moon fired back, it's disappointing to see our opponent defending profiteers and Wall Street interests who are inflating Seattle's housing market for their own gain, end quote. Ouch. Carrie Moon is basing her proposal on Vancouver, where they have a 15% tax on foreigners who buy real estate. Is it working to tamp down skyrocketing real estate prices? The Record asked Stephen Quinn, host of the CBC's On the Coast.
The impact of it was swift. It was deep, but it did bounce back to almost where we were more than a year later. The feeling being that, you know, people have found a way to get around the tax. People might have a relative here who is purchasing the property on their behalf or in their name. And it's interesting because, no, it's done nothing to lower home prices. All it's done, and it did this temporarily, was slow down real estate transactions.
So that's what they say it did and didn't do in Vancouver. Let's start with the premise of this idea. Foreign buyers are the ones who might be driving this up. Mike McGinn, less than an hour ago, you endorsed Carrie Moon for mayor. Do you agree with the premise of this policy, that speculators are treating Seattle real estate like an investment? They're betting on prices going up, which is generally a good bet in Seattle, and thereby causing prices to rise to levels that make Seattle unaffordable. Do you think that the rise in real estate prices here is driven in large part by speculation?
So there's kind of two things I want to say here. First, one is I do think it's natural that when you have a market as hot as this, where the price appreciation of homes and buildings has been so high, that it's going to attract capital that's looking for a safe place to park and or build value. The important point I want to raise here is that when you look at Carrie Moon's platform, she does not characterize it, nor does she describe it as a foreign buyer's tax. This is a tax that's on speculation no matter where it comes from, whether it's coming from Wall Street or California or China. Yes, she did mention China because that is one of the places the money is coming from.
Well, I want to
get
to that.
But she's very clear on that point as well.
And I want to get to that in a moment. But first of all, is this really the cause of driving up prices? We've talked to real estate agents who've said that foreigners investing here doesn't really affect affordable housing at all. It might be driving up the high end of the market, your million-dollar plus things. They say it's kind of on the sidelines. Do you think the premise is fair that affordable housing is being affected by this investment?
I think the premise is fair that capital will flow into places where it can make the most money. And right now, this is a great place to make money, is Seattle real estate. I mean, we have one of the fastest growing real estate markets. In fact, I think it's naive to assume that capital isn't going to flow here. Now, that's at the heart, too, of what Carrie Moon's been requesting. Let's start the analysis to try to get to the bottom of this and get an understanding of
it. Let's start the analysis. She hasn't done the analysis, and she's already coming up with the solution.
Well, you really are going to have to dig in and take a look at this. But again, you know, there's enough. I'm reminded of when I was a lawyer. You know, when you see the tracks of the deer in the backyard, that you didn't see the deer, but you sure as hell knew it was walking through the snow. And so I think we have that evidence here that when the capital, you know, when the markets are going through the roof like they are, you're going to tell me that people from Wall Street or real estate investors around the nation and around the globe aren't going to try to tap into that and make money.
Joni and Chris,
that analysis has to be then, you know, how are they doing it and how do we deal with it?
Well, what about the other two of you, Joni and Chris? Do you think that real estate speculation must be tamped down to forestall the big increases in real estate here?
No. First of all, what's driving up the cost of housing is the same thing that drives up the cost of any commodity, and that's supply and demand. People want to live in Seattle, so housing is expensive here. There's other things, of course, that play into it. But Carrie Moon and Lisa Herbold and others didn't just ask for this information. You know, they want it to drive a policy that they've already decided on, is they want a tax, a property tax, on these properties just as they've done in Vancouver. Let's start with, now, full disclosure,
I work part-time as a professor at the UW. I do some consulting, and I work part-time on the leadership team of King County Assessor John Wilson, who's been a big part of this debate. A tax on foreign buyers would violate the uniformity clause of the Washington State Constitution. This is clearly, unmistakably, black-letter law, unconstitutional. So that's the first thing. Second thing, this data doesn't exist in the assessor's office or anywhere else.
The data which would show that it's foreign speculation that's driving up these costs?
Correct. And okay. And finally, a lot of people see this as going down a slippery slope towards, again, you know, a dark past in this city, which is profiling people by race and stigmatizing people from China who want to buy these properties. And so this is, I can see exactly why this blew up as a very controversial issue.
Let's circle back to that in a moment. But Joni, do we know enough to say that, yes, it's speculation that's driving up these real estate prices and making it so unaffordable for so many Seattleites?
I think that's the key point here, is there's so much about this that we don't know. And I end up in the middle. I want to know. I want to know who's doing it, what's doing it. We're all just talking here about what we think is the truth. Look, this is the first real dust up of the general election. It's ugly, or it's taken this ugly turn here. I spent some time yesterday with Carrie Moon, who I'd never met before, honestly, yesterday afternoon. She's somewhat convincing about the fact that she's after the speculation, U.S. or foreign. Just let's find out about it. So where I end up is, I don't know how to get this information, but I know that some people have ways to find out something about it. So I would absolutely love to know more about this. Is this a real thing? And I think that the effort to find out will answer some of this. Maybe it's all U.S. investment funds. We don't know who it is. We don't even know how much it is or whether it's affecting our market. But more information, is that a problem? Since when is that an issue that we don't want?
Well, why? Okay, all of a sudden we aren't worried about privacy. I mean, where is the consumer private?
Well, it depends on how you do it.
People have a right to buy and sell property. It's entirely legal. So now we're going to go on a witch hunt and talk about who is buying property and who's selling it to them. I don't want my records about my property that I may or may not own or buy be made public.
That's where the assessor's office got a little bit, you know, over its head here by saying that we're going to have some list. It doesn't have to be a list of the names. Let's just find out how big the problem is.
So
I don't need your name and address and your phone number. There's clearly debate
about, do we have the information to show that this is actually true? But I want to talk about the tone of it. And you alluded to that, Joni. Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin, it's been fairly peaceful. Now we've got charges of being anti-Chinese, of defending profiteers. Mike, you've been in this campaign. Is it going to get more negative from now to November? How do you see this going?
Well, first of all, as I said, Carrie Moon's platform was very clear, you know, that it was not raising that issue. And the fact that Jenny Durkin went there so quickly actually tells me a few things. One, that the Durkin campaign's worried. They feel they need to make a negative attack on Carrie Moon. Two, it was actually pretty divisive, you know, to raise it and to go straight there and make that attack. And doesn't bode well. I mean, we have a very divisive nation. I think we're looking for something better here. But it was also a very canny political tactic by Jenny Durkin. It was, you know, kind of our local version of swift boating, you know, make something up and go right at the strength of Carrie Moon, which is dealing with affordability and looking out for people that are getting priced out. And Jenny Durkin just decided, we'll just go try to drive a wedge between her and her own supporters with something that wasn't really very factual.
Joni, swift boating?
No, I don't know about the swift boating, but I was going to say, look, a lot of cities on the West Coast where the housing prices are going up are trying to get at this in different ways. And so, you know, Vancouver, as you just mentioned, had not only a tax on foreign buyers, they had a vacancy tax. San Francisco has a board of supervisors person down there has proposed a vacancy tax. People are trying to get at this issue. It would be better for the city, I think, if we got at the issue with full information and not with these kinds of attacks. Although politically, I understand it, you know, we have a large block of Asian voters.
Chris, you know, this is very interesting. I don't live in Seattle. I have to say that virtually every time I'm on here.
But
I
you're a close political observer.
I haven't endorsed either campaigns. Side. But honestly, different people who I think different people I've talked to and have been around, including my boss, the assessor, who are all Democrats, all liberals, they see this issue differently. Some people see this and honestly, it's not a political tactic. See this as a dangerous move towards a racist policy. Others look at it and don't see that. It's really interesting to me the way reasonable people can look at this issue and see it two different completely ways.
Joni, politically speaking, does it make sense that we might see the campaign rhetoric harshening between now and November? Do you think this is,
oh,
is
absolutely.
This just a one-off?
Oh, absolutely. These
you candidates, think we'll see more of this?
These candidates have to differentiate themselves in voters' eyes. The voters don't know either of them very well. They're both newcomers in many, many ways. They're unknowns. So they're going to have to slice things so that people can tell who they are. The fact that they slice this one in this way, you know, makes people's shoulders go up a bit because it's a little icky the way it's turned out. And Asian voters are an important voting bloc if they are offended as a voting bloc. I'm not saying they are, but it's a big deal, yes. And, you know, you talk a lot about, we've all talked a lot about, oh, you know, the women candidates, they'll be different. It'll be the first female mayor. I mean, they'll be different in some ways, like once they get to working, but they're not that different. Campaigns are going to have their unfriendly moments.
I'd like to move on to beyond
Mike.
I'd like to move on.
I just want to say that, you know, Jenny Durkin is a very political person, so this is not at all surprising.
Let's talk a little bit about another aspect of this, and that's up until now, a lot of the focus has been on endorsements. And Mike McGinn, you just endorsed Carrie Moon. Yeah. King County Democrats have also endorsed Carrie Moon for mayor. Jenny Durkin continues to have a string of endorsements from labor unions. Now, I've always thought that endorsements were important in the primary when people aren't that focused on the election. But how about in the general election? How important are these endorsements, Chris?
Some endorsements can make a big difference. It seems pretty clear the stranger makes a big difference in the city of Seattle. Getting a political party's endorsement, then you get their entire infrastructure behind you. Endorsements really matter if something comes with it. If a union is then going to turn out hundreds of people to ring doorbells or something like that. And like I said, I think the stranger is viewed as sort of the spokesperson of the super progressive left in Seattle, generally. So some endorsements can make a big deal. I mean, they make a big difference.
So as somebody who was in the endorsement business for quite a while, and I'm not going to endorse in this race.
At the Seattle Times editorial board.
Seattle Times editorial board. I'm certainly not endorsing in this race because I'm hosting a debate on October 16th, so not going to touch that one. I've always thought of endorsements, so I never had like a big, huge opinion of the impact of that. But I think endorsements are part of the narrative of a race, the trajectory of it. And so depending on what we're talking about here, if you get one endorsement, say in a statewide race, not that big a deal. But if you get most of them, that's sort of more compelling. In the city of Seattle, it is true that the Seattle Times has some sway and that the stranger's impact has come up with the loss of the PI. Yes, of course it did. That's my take on how that worked. So because we had this discussion on this show, the stranger kind of did it in half. They were, what was the vote? Five for Kerry,
right.
And four for...
Right, it was kind of a split decision.
So split is wimpier, if you don't mind my saying, but it helped Kerry Moon.
Mike, you just endorsed Carrie Moon. What are the importance of these endorsements? Of course, yours is going to be hugely crucial.
Oh, absolutely.
But talking in a broader sense,
Mike McGinn on the cover of The Stranger, that didn't...
Yeah, no, actually, no. The Stranger endorsement in 2009 was critical, as it was in 2013. I think Chris described it accurately, the overall. It's really what comes along with the endorsement that really matters. I think what's really interesting about the King County Dems endorsement is that, you know, it tends to reward people who have deeper ties to the Democratic Party. And unquestionably, Jenny Durkin has deeper ties to the Democratic Party over time than Carrie Moon. She's a little more of an outsider. So the fact that the Dems went, the county Dems went with Carrie Moon, it's more helping us understand the dynamic of what's going on out there, then it's going to change the outcome of the race. But what it tells us is there's some hunger in the Democratic Party for some outsiders to enter the race.
It's sort of the Bernie wing is ascendant. Is
well, absolutely.
Explain
absolutely.
This to me, though. King County Democrats, a lot of King County Democrats are not in Seattle, will not be voting on the Seattle mayor's race. Explain to me, does that really represent what Seattle Democrats say?
Well, I think that'll be interesting. And we'll see, because we'll see each of the Democratic Party organization is organized by legislative district. And I think there are seven of them that touch Seattle. So we'll go through a bunch of them. And, you know, the 43rd representing Capitol Hill in the U District is most liberal. We'll see what they do. We'll see what West Seattle does. We'll see what everyone does.
So there'll be more endorsements to come.
Well, there's many more to come, districts. And we'll start getting some answers to that question.
Chris? The vote of the Democratic Party in King County, and then there were between 50 and 100, you know, the key Democratic activists in King County there, and the fact that over 60% of them voted to endorse Carrie Moon, and she's considered, I think, you know, the more progressive. It's just a continuing manifestation of what's happening in this country. Both parties are losing their minds. Both parties are running as fast and as hard as they can.
He was so dying to say that.
Both parties are choosing the most radical options in every possible scenario. They're moving as far to the right and as far to the left as they can. The center is falling in this country, and it is. I know a lot of Democrats who are taken aback by this and are worried, and believe me, Republicans are, I mean, we've gone beyond worried about what's happening in our party. Again, both parties are moving to the fringes as fast as they possibly can.
And I know that's a big issue for you. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But let's talk a little bit about the money. I think that Jenny Durkin has something like a 3-to-1 advantage when of money raised. What's that going to buy her?
That's going to buy her plenty
advertising.
Advertising, plenty of direct mail, plenty of online advertising. I mean, money does matter in these races. Right. You can definitely do money to results in a lot of cases.
But the conventional wisdom about this race is that Carrie Moon is a self-funder and that she will, when it's necessary, put more of her own money in. So Durkin may not have as big a financial advantage as it appears on paper.
Mike, as an endorser of Carrie Moon, you think that's right?
Oh, money of course matters, but message matters too. I mean, you got to carry a message with your money, and I think that's what everyone's looking for in this race, is what's the message, and you know, I actually agree a lot with Chris when he talks about the lack of the center, but I think we're talking more at the national level. I think if you look at these two candidates, which one's closer to the center of Seattle politics? We're about to find out the answer. We're a pretty progressive place.
A quick survey here. I'm not even going to ask you, Mike, because you've just endorsed Carrie Moon.
Sure.
For the other two of you, though, knowing what you know right now, who's going to win in November?
I've talked to people close to the race, and they say it's too close to call right now.
What about you, Joni?
So clearly Jenny Durkin is the front runner, but I think what I learned from the King County Democratic endorsement is it's going to be closer than people thought. This isn't a Jenny for sure type of a situation. It's going to be a close race. It depends on how many people think it's fascinating that Carrie Moon's an engineer. Could be the revenge of the engineers who have all moved here. We don't know how they vote or even if they vote, for that matter.
It's not even Labor Day. It's not even Labor Day. We have two full months. There's a lot still to happen.
Yeah. As we've been talking about, politics are really inflamed in this country. And Chris Vance, you're part of a new group that aims to transcend this partisanship. Give us your elevator pitch for centrist politics.
Yeah, anybody would say right now that there's a third-party movement that can today challenge the two major parties. They're fooling themselves. But there is a real growing centrist movement in this country, more and more people looking for an alternative. Today, the rumor is out there that Governor John Kasich is looking to run for president, perhaps on a ticket with a Democrat governor from Colorado, Hickenlooper. And there is a new group out there that I'm becoming involved in called the Centrist Project, which it's a political action committee. Its objective is to raise millions of dollars to support people who are willing to run for office as centrist independents. And they are very serious. I went to a meeting in Philadelphia. There's some
not Republicans, not Democrats.
Not Democrats.
Are you not a Republican anymore, Jesus?
Moving on.
No, not today.
The governor of Alaska is an independent. The state treasurer in Maine, who's been elected statewide, was a Democrat legislator, is now running for governor as an independent. The Centrist Project's identified between 10 and 15 serious candidates who are going to run for governor and U.S. senator next year as independents. This is just beginning, but I think we are starting to see a realignment of American politics and the emergence of something moving up, rising in the center to challenge the two parties.
I have to ask, though, political success seems to be predicated not just on what you're for, mm-hmm. but being against the correct thing, being against the Democrats mm-hmm. if you're on that side, being against Trump if you're on the other side. Won't centrist candidates just be caught in a crossfire?
No, this is the message on this is very clear. Both parties are a mess. Both parties have let us down. Neither party has any answers. The current system is broken. Centrist candidates and independent candidates can run against the status quo, against the current system, and have a very powerful message.
Mike McGinn, do you see any hope for this type of central politics?
I think that there is some type of party realignment occurring in this country. And I don't know how it's going to shake out yet. I mean, I think that the Republican Party is really, really damaged right now because Trump is so alienating even to Republicans. And I think the Democratic Party has been struggling as well for a long time. And that was, you know, the Bernie Sanders versus Hillary Clinton, the degree to which the party is run from the top and serving, you know, the elites. And I think that's a bigger issue than left, right, and center. We want to put everything onto this horizontal spectrum. But I think there's another spectrum, which is that a lot of people don't feel like they're represented by either party, but that they can be anywhere on the ideological spectrum and feel that way because they feel like those that have money are the ones benefiting and those without aren't. And you can hear from people at any part of the spectrum saying this. So I think it's a question of which party is going to start realigning to grab that. Trump did it, but he did it in a way that was so racist and so damaging that they're going to lose. Let's see if the Democrats can do it.
But Chris isn't talking about realigning. He's talking about centrist politics. Joni, do you think there's any hope for a movement like that?
Well, I actually would hope for something like that. I think that would be far more productive than what we have right now. But the history on it, and you can point to independents elected here and there, but there is not like a big groundswell or a big history of folks of independents that have been elected in this country. So it's tough. If that's the word, it's just tough to make that happen. Saying it's not admirable to seek it. I'm just saying it's hard to do it.
You know, politics is about data. And if you look at the data, the overwhelming majority of the American people are sick and tired of the Republicans and Democrats. They're sick and tired of the status quo. They just haven't had an alternative. One more example. Greg Orman, who ran as an independent in Kansas for the U.S. Senate and nearly won, is probably going to run as an independent for governor of Kansas next year. This is so new, most people don't know about it, but Joni, watch over the next few months. You're going to see a wave of well-financed, serious candidates emerge with serious help behind them to run as independents in states
across the country.
We'll see how they do.
And how about you, Chris Vance, who just said you're not a Republican today, former chair of the Republican Party. Is this someplace you might want to locate yourself?
I'm going to be part of this new movement. I don't know in what role yet. They are still deciding what type of infrastructure to build here in the state of Washington. So I don't know exactly what my role is going to be, but I am very attracted to this. The Republican Party has gone insane, and the Democrats are close behind.
And on that note, stick around. Still to come, two police officers sue City Council member Shama Sawant for calling them murderers. It's The Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke with former Republican Party Chair Chris Vance, Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, and former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. More when our program continues. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's Week in Review with former Republican Party Chair Chris Vance, former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, and Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail at the Seattle Channel. Well, the city of Seattle is going to spend at least $250,000 defending legal attacks against the high earner income tax. Passed by the city council, signed into law by the mayor, city council passed it on a 9-0 vote. My question for you, and I genuinely don't know the answer to this, is it common that a local agency, a local mayor or a local government would pass laws that they know they're going to have to spend a lot of money to defend in court? Does this happen all the time and I just haven't noticed it?
No, it doesn't. It never happened. For 8 years I was in the King County Council, we never knowingly passed a law that we knew was going to end up in court. But the Seattle City Council did this on purpose. They are trying to challenge, you know, the Supreme Court rulings on the income tax.
So you
And they're going to lose. I mean, there isn't a lawyer on the planet that thinks that Seattle has a case here.
Joni, and you've had a long experience in local politics. Is it that common that we have this kind of direct challenge to what appears to be the law?
Well, I think what Chris is trying to say and what I observe here is, you know, it wouldn't be that common to always, you know, to frequently be passing laws that require so much legal defense. But think about it. This is a city council that is activist, that wants to push the envelope, that wants to challenge long-held law here in the state. And so that sounds expensive to me. That sounds like you need an outside legal team or an inside legal team, for that matter, to find out if your laws that you're pushing the envelope. That's what they all want to do down there. You've spoken to them.
Yeah.
You're one of them almost.
She's pointing to Mike McGinn. And Mike McGinn, you supported the high earner income tax also.
Sure did.
There's a real risk that instead of bringing money into the city, this tax could end up costing Seattle taxpayers. Why is it worth the risk?
Well, on the back up a little bit, it happens all the time that laws that are passed get challenged legally. We're going to see some of the zoning laws get challenged legally. They're already being challenged. When I took office in 2010, Greg Nichols was trying to prevent guns from being carried around in community centers and parks, and that was challenged by, you know, the Second Amendment Foundation, who won. But I think it was worth pushing because it was a goal worth fighting for, and there was a legal argument to be made as to why the city was right. I think the public wants the city to test this. It's not just the city council. Everybody's going into this with their eyes open that there's going to be a legal challenge. And I think it's one of those things that the public wants the city to go down this path and find out the answer one way or the other. And if it costs a little money, that's kind of the cost of doing business in a big city. There's lawsuits going on all the time about all sorts of things.
You're a lawyer, though, right?
Yeah.
The city really win on this? Chris pretty much dismissed it. He said it's kind of open and closed.
You know, they're giving it their best shot. They have an argument that they believe can carry the day. Let them test it and find out. I mean, there's only one way to find that out, and that's to have the lawsuit. And again, I think the public wants the city to find out.
Chris, you're still shaking your
head. Well, I understand Seattle's frustration. If you are a progressive Seattle voter, anyone lives in Seattle, you should be upset with the state of Washington at their inability to reform our tax code that's really hurt local government, at you know how long it's taken us to build a decent transit system in this region, which has needed one my entire lifetime, and a whole host of other things. I understand Seattle's frustration and the desire to go it alone. You know, let's just fix our own problems here. But when you take an oath of office that you're going to be a lawmaker, you're supposed to uphold the Constitution. And if you can read, the Washington State Constitution and see that this is clearly unconstitutional. You shouldn't vote to pass things that you know are unconstitutional.
I'd like to pull the focus back a little bit. Seattle's certainly been on a tax and spending spree in recent years.
No.
The Municipal League has recently issued a report. I don't think it got the attention it deserved, but it says that Seattle's really in danger of a budget crisis, a thing where you might not have to close down certain programs in order to keep the fire departments open. And their reasoning is this. They say the city could be overextended because there's going to be a recession. There will be a recession at some point. The Trump administration could revoke federal spending. And they also say that voters just might tire of approving tax levies. Mm-hmm. Even though the economy is booming, is this a moment for fiscal caution, Joni?
Well, it's always a moment for fiscal caution, but you're not going to see it from this council because they have been very successful at asking voters for new money for a variety of different things. And so I don't see that. I mean, long term, you're exactly right. But if you go to the other story we're going to talk about, the Amazon thing seems like it's just charging ahead like crazy. And I'm not trying to get too far ahead on that. And, you know, and this city council knows that the voters are very generous, that they say yes to quite a lot of stuff. And so now it's not like we're hearing about fewer tax streams coming into the city. I'm writing a piece right now about how many more tax streams people are talking about, including the one that we mentioned at the very beginning here.
Mike McGinn, you actually made a note fiscal caution in your campaign. But do you think it could be at the point where we really have to pull back now or there could be a real crisis?
Yeah, a couple of points. First, the mayor sets the tone more than anyone on the budget because he writes the first one. In the future, we'll say she writes the first one.
And they change it by like 5 to 6%.
Yeah, it's
a lot of noise, not much change.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of change that comes from the council. So the leadership is really from the mayor on this. There's a deeper point, which is that every city is actually looking at serious budget issues because we've built our places in ways that are not financially sustainable. And, you know, we've heard the phrase sprawl before, but basically we have so many miles of road and pipes and electrical wires and not a sufficient tax base to take care of them because it's spread out. Seattle's no different than any other city in this regard. And fiscal caution is required, you know, to a far greater degree than we're seeing right now. I don't think people know how big our maintenance backlogs are in the city.
They're huge, but they're kind of hidden. But how do you say no when the city is facing such pressing problems? Walk down any street, you'll see homeless people there. Can anyone really say no? Joni?
Yeah, I mean, the voters can say no, except they don't do it very often. I wanted to add a footnote to the discussion about the income tax. It's fascinating to me that two of the plaintiffs in some of the lawsuits against the council's income tax are Faye Garneau and Susie Burke are two people who actually are the ones who helped finance or fully financed or something like that, helped finance the district elections,
yes,
which is what brought us a lot of the sort of left, more of the left-leaning council members, which brought us the income tax.
Hmm.
And I just think it's like, are you having fun yet?
There has to be at some point a breaking point, and there's different ways this can happen. But, you know, next in November, the voters of King County are going to vote on whether or not to reauthorize the Veterans and Human Services levy, which the King County Council just doubled the size of it. So that's a big tax increase to provide really needed services and the reason that's necessary is because the idiotic Tim Eyman 1% property tax cap limits the county's general fund. Now, also, people need to understand that in 2018, their property taxes are going to go way up because of the McCleary legislation that the legislature passed. In 2018, there's a huge increase in the state share of the property tax, and the local levies don't go down until 2019. So for 2018, people are going to have major sticker shock on their property taxes. At some point, even Seattleites are going to say, I can't afford to live here anymore.
Let's turn to another story. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. Two Seattle police officers have sued Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant for defamation for describing the police shooting of Shea Taylor as murder. Here's just one example of what Sawant said at a city council briefing earlier this year.
I think we have to take into account the actual fact that Shea Taylor was painted as a criminal, even though he was murdered by the police.
She's called this shooting a murder several times. The two officers say they don't want any money from the city. They're seeking damages from Sawant herself. Now, there's a real high bar in winning a defamation case against a public figure, and I want to get your thoughts on the law in a moment. But first of all, is it appropriate for an elected official to call police officers murderers?
Can I just say that,
sure.
No one likes a rush to judgment in the case of a tragedy. We all object to that when it's Donald Trump, and we should object to that when it's Shama Sawant. Police officers' lives are on the line every day. Do they really need a council member before she knows what exactly is going on to call them the murderers? Really, that is amazing. I, of course, I'm not for police officers recklessly shooting anyone. Just not for that. So my thought here is it's kind of like a brushback pitch for Shama Sawant. You know, she does talk before she thinks. This is maybe one time she's going to be asked to think first and malign second.
Mike McGinn, what do you think about those comments from Shama Sawant that she made a bunch of times? Now she's being sued for.
You know, I think that when you're in the position she's in, which has, you know, direct, you know, budget control and some level of control over the police department, I don't think it's appropriate. But I also want to say there's not been much of a focus on what actually happened there with Shea Taylor. And there's a lot of frustration and anger, you know, from those who feel he was unjustly shot and killed. And I think that's what you see in response is this level of concern from, you know, from those who feel like this hasn't been looked at.
There has been an inquiry.
Yeah, and you know, I look at this. And I was mayor when John Williams was shot, and the Firearms Review Board found that the officer had put himself into the position where he felt he had no other choice. If you look at this shooting, the officers rushed him. One was telling him to get down. The other one was telling him to put his hands up. They had guns drawn, and then they concluded that he was reaching for a gun. This is a shooting that has not had sufficient scrutiny. And the standards are so difficult, which is why there's the statewide measure to change the standards. The standards high that it gets, you know, so I think that's the level of frustration you see from those who want a deeper investigation, who want greater accountability. You know, their rhetoric goes up, but it's not coming from nowhere.
Chris Vance, what does it do when a city council member calls police officers murderers?
It just throws a whole lot of gasoline on a fire that's already out there. And some people just don't make the transition from activist to elected official. And it's different.
I agree completely.
When you're an elected official, you have a fiduciary duty to the government you represent. Things you say might get your government sued. You call, and also just no American should call anyone else a murderer until they are convicted of murder. And they went through a long process here, and these officers have not been convicted of murder. So what she said is outrageous. Now, I have great sympathy for those who believe that there's been a disproportionality in our criminal justice system and that African Americans are treated differently on the street. I completely understand that and am sympathetic towards it. But when you're not there and you didn't see what happened and you just use the word murderer, no one should do that, and especially not someone who, again, has taken the public responsibility of being an elected official.
It's really tough to win a defamation suit against a public figure. You not only you have to prove that the person who said the statement was wrong and knew it was wrong and acted in malice in making that charge. I don't know if any of the three of you have had any experience with defamation cases, but do the cops have a chance in court of getting this?
I don't know.
I don't know either if they have a chance because it's very hard to prove the intent.
And the lawyer on the panel?
But you know what? I would love to, I think it's time to have that discussion so we can hear what is said about it. If the end result is that Sawant, who's all bullhorn half the time, you know, decides to pull it back a little, that would be productive for our city.
Well, of course, you have to prove malice, that there was some intent to defame by Sharma. But we also know that truth is a defense. So look for Sharma to try to prove the truth of her statement. So in that respect, is she going to embrace this debate and this trial so that she can shine a spotlight on the shooting itself?
Well, at this point, we would know if these officers were being charged with murder. And as far as I know, they are not.
A civil case, the standard of liability in a civil case is different than the standard of liability that there would be in a criminal case. So much like O.J. Simpson was acquitted, but then also was found to be liable to the family for his actions. So who knows how that mix of burdens of proof will play out here. But she will have her day in court because it's preponderance of the evidence here, not beyond a reasonable doubt.
And there are some civil cases in the Shea Taylor case, are there not?
There are some. I believe there are some, or there will be some if there aren't already.
You know, Sawant has an easier way out of this by just simply saying that the officer said they just wanted an apology. And she could rethink what she said and say that she rushed to judgment, she went too far, too fast, and maybe that would be the end of it.
That would be interesting. Up ahead, is Amazon a good corporate citizen? How about the Lenin statue in Fremont? Should it come down? It's Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke with Joni Balter, Mike McGinn, and Chris Vance. More after this break. I'm Ross Reynolds. It's Week in Review. I'm in for Bill Radke with former Republican Party Chair Chris Vance, Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, and former Mayor Mike McGinn. We don't have Von Huberman here, our social media person, but Mike, you said you've been handling that role today. I see you looking at your phone. Anything interesting
Chris
coming
is
over?
Looking
okay,
at
you
phone
okay? Too. You've got your tweeter back up and going. Mm-hmm. Somebody's working on your behalf now.
Okay, good. The Federal Trade Commission has approved Amazon's acquisition of grocery store chain Whole Foods. And when that acquisition becomes final on Monday, Amazon is promising to immediately lower prices at the grocery store known by some as Whole Paycheck. And another sign of Amazon's omnipotence, a Seattle Times story reveals that the company owns as much office space as the city's next 40 biggest employers combined. And they're going to acquire 4 million more square feet of office space in 5 years. In the interest of full disclosure, KUOW received a grant from Amazon for our Ask a series of person-to-person conversations. Before I get to your answers, do any of you have any Amazon-related disclosures to make? Joni, you mentioned you're a Prime member.
I'm a Prime member. Is that okay?
That's okay.
Yeah. Okay. Other than buying about half everything we buy. But
okay.
No.
All right. So the joke used to be that South Lake Union was becoming Amazonia, but now it seems like the entire city is becoming Amazonia. Is this too much of a good thing?
Well, that remains to be seen if it's too much of a good thing. But the fact is that Amazon's rate of growth is breathtaking. I'm working on my second piece about this topic for Bloomberg View right now. And I was toying with some stats just to try to get them right. So in May, when I wrote my piece, I was supposed to say we'll soon occupy more than 10 million square feet of office space. And I saw in the Seattle Times piece, and I double-checked with Amazon folks, now we're supposed to say 12 million square feet by 2020. At the time in May, I mentioned more than 30,000 Seattle employees. I think it was 33 at the time. Now I saw in the story more than 40. I mean, this is going very quickly. The city is changing dramatically. You know, it is the other really interesting fact in the Seattle Times piece was the fact that we will be the largest company town because of Amazon. I mean, they are really, really, this is the biggest story of our region right now.
It's interesting you mentioned wait and see. I talked to a lot of folks in the Belltown neighborhood wondering what they were thinking about this behemoth kind of growing right on the edge. And they were all sort of taking a wait-and-see attitude. They see how it could be mutually beneficial to the neighborhood, but there were maybe some concerns in the background, nothing they were willing to talk about yet. But is it getting to be a little too much, Mike?
Well, you know, getting back to the question you asked earlier about, you know, how can we keep paying for everything? This is actually an awesome opportunity to pay for everything if we're prepared to tax Amazon and the other companies that are choosing to locate here. I was saying part of the problem with paying for everything was when you're spread out, how difficult it is. But now we have an employer who's using all of our existing infrastructure, and we need more, right? We need more housing, we need more transit, but we need to, you know, this is an opportunity to capture that wealth that's being created in the city and put it to the common good, and we should be looking at that. That's one point. The other point, I think, is if you look regionally, the actor, what works in the world economy is the metro region, not the city. And if you look regionally, we do have a lot of other big companies, too. So, yeah, it has a huge impact locally. We should capture that wealth to deal with the impact. But regionally, we've got a lot of other big employers, too.
So it's such it is such a Seattle thing to worry about too much success, too much growth, too many jobs.
Said the man from Auburn.
That's true. You know, go take a look at Detroit or Milwaukee or Cleveland or any of the other Rust Belt cities. Yeah, I live in Auburn. I was born in Seattle, and I'm a Seattle native. I've lived here my whole life. And the city, the entire history of Seattle is change. We physically change this place. We tear down hills. We build infrastructure. And Seattle is ever changing. And right now, it's a boom time. And it's beautiful. I mean, the changes that are being made. Seattle is a fantastic, world-class city. And I understand it causes a lot of stress and gentrification, but it's a lot better than the alternative, you know, which is everybody moving away.
It's my understanding they pay more taxes than any other company in the city. They've donated an old hotel for a homeless shelter, and they're setting aside space in a new office building for homeless housing. They do really good work supporting the restaurant job training program, Fair Start. But, Mike, you kind of intimated that that might not be enough. They need to do more.
So Mike even proposed the famous Amazon tax.
Well, she's calling it that.
No, KUOW called it that.
Oh, there we go.
Precise as to who exactly
Look,
called it that first.
A decade ago or two decades ago, cities were desperate to land employers in their downtowns because employers were doing what Microsoft was doing or T-Mobile or AT&T Wireless. They were locating out on the fringes, which has huge costs to regions to take care of. People wanted them in the downtowns. That era is over. They're here, and they're not here because it's cheap or the parking's easy or traffic's good. They're here because this is where all the people are that they want. These companies want to be in city. Weyerhaeuser moved here, for crying out loud, from an award-winning campus down next to I-5. We don't have to worry about taxing them too much anymore. They have to be here. I'm sure there's a point where we would be taxing them too much. That is so far from where we are right now. So they're benefiting from the growth in the city. They're benefiting from the beauty of the city. They can pay more. And we should try to capture that wealth they're creating for the benefit of everybody instead of pushing all the costs of growth onto everybody else.
So Chris Vance, does Amazon have a special responsibility because of their size?
No. They're a company. Why punish them for coming here? And also, I don't know how you would do that. Again, and there's a thing in the Washington State Constitution called the Uniformity Clause, which means you must tax everyone equally. You can't pass a special tax just for someone else. But what you can do, actually, is pass exemptions to the sales tax. But other than that, we don't have an income tax, and you cannot tax selectively with the property tax. And you can't – I don't know how you would enact some sort of Amazon tax.
Mike's got an answer to that.
Sure. Redmond charges $109 per employee that resides within the town. We had it here until the King County Council got rid of it at the behest of the Chamber of Commerce in 2009. We could easily have a per employee tax on every company, Amazon.
His proposal was $100 per employee for companies 50 and over, to be clear.
That would raise tens of millions of dollars a year.
Well, that's very different. Stuff. That is constitutional, probably.
I interviewed...
The last thing Seattle needs, though, is more money.
That's also true. I interviewed a professor for this piece I was working on, Justin Marlowe from the Evans School, and he was talking about exactly what you were talking about a few moments ago, Mike McGinn, about how long ago, yes, the fear was that if you taxed the companies that they would leave town. And he cited examples of New York and Kansas City back in the 60s and 70s. But his point now is that one of the attractions of working for Amazon is to be in downtown Seattle. So that the idea that you can pick up and leave, you know, hey, if there's too much taxing going on in Seattle, Amazon will just bolt. No, they won't. Not with all the buildings they're building. They're not going to bolt.
For decades, Boeing CEOs have stood before crowds and said, if you keep taxing the way you do in Washington State, we're going to move elsewhere. And guess what? They're moving elsewhere. So business is very simple. If you can make more money by locating somewhere else, eventually there's a tipping point, and you do.
Point taken. Mayor Ed Murray has called for taking down two statues, one honoring Confederate Civil War veterans. It's in a private cemetery. And the other, Russian communist Vladimir Lenin, that statue has towered over Fremont for years. Here's what the mayor had to say.
You know, that monument represents to many people in the city their families having been murdered, the destructions of tens of millions of people. If I were Eastern European American or a Jewish American, I'm not sure how I'd feel about that monument. So I think it's time for these things to go. They don't represent the best of who we are.
Now, we had listeners calling into the Record this week to air their thoughts. Here's what Ian suggested.
I was thinking the problem with the Fremont Lenin statue could be solved with a little rebranding. I think we all need to be pushing the hashtag, that's Ivor, not Lenin, to show people that our local hero, Ivor Haglund, is actually the subject of that statue. Maybe I had a couple oversized seagulls to match the other statues around town.
Joni Balter, is the statue of Lenin in Fremont offensive to you?
I think it is kind of offensive. I mean, it was brought in to be kind of kitschy and ironic and all this good stuff. But, you know, I make a distinction between pedestals and museums. So I say it's fine with me. I'm not going to cry if they take it down. Lenin was a barbarian. I think the people on statues and pedestals should be, you know, Seattle greats. Ivar, if you want to mention Ivar, Ken Griffey Jr., Chief Seattle, Jimi Hendrix. I mean, that's who should be high in the pedestal.
How about you, Chris? Do you think the mayor has a point? Should the statue of Lenin?
I have never understood erecting monuments to villains. And those who fought for human slavery to defend rebels in the United States, I've never understood Confederate monuments and naming military base. What other country names stuff after people who tried to were disloyal to the United States? And totalitarian communism was one of the most evil forces ever unleashed on this planet, killed hundreds of millions of people. Lenin is a villain to history. And why we have a statue for him, I do not understand it. Absolutely come down.
How about you, Mike?
Well, I've always actually been a little bit bothered by the statute, too, but I think you have to recognize that the intent of the people putting it up was very different than the intent of the people putting up the Confederate monuments. And having said that, you know, impact matters as well. And, you know, that's what Mayor Ed Murray is talking about. It has an impact on people. So, you know, I think this is where, you know, there's a good discussion to be had here, but I'm not as bothered by the Lenin statue because of the original intent behind it, and it's obviously wasn't being put up on a pedestal and being put up for adoration in the way that the Confederate war monuments were being built. And I think you need to take that into account when you look at why it was put up there and what we should do next.
And finally, today for the Week in Review, the parking garage next door to KUOW was swarming with office workers Monday morning to see the 93% solar eclipse. Record producer Matt Martin was in the path of totality in Corvallis with his nieces and nephews.
Oh, Lisa, look at it!
Oh, my goodness!
Look at it. There's barely anything left.
It's almost gone.
Mike McGinn, I understand this was a family expedition for you, too.
Yeah, my son, Keen, and a couple of friends of mine, we drove down to Oregon and climbed up on a ridgeline near Rock Creek Butte. Sarah Bernhardt at the Seattle Weekly wrote about being on top of Rock Creek Butte and her experience. So, yeah, it was really amazing. It was better than I expected, and there was a lot of anticipation about it, too.
Joni, did you have a special eclipse experience this week?
Very special in the sense that 2 minutes before the eclipse, my neighbor proffered two of the special sunglasses. I didn't have any, so that was awesome. You know, I was surprised it didn't turn as dark as folks had thought it would.
Me too.
And I felt like I'd, you know, it was pretty amazing to look at it through those glasses. Yes, indeed. What I found that I didn't know anything about was even more spectacular was the shadow, those riplets, those shell-shaped shadows. And I wanted to hold them and have them stay longer, and they left so quickly.
You could hold your hands up and hash across your fingers, and you could see the little reflection
scoop,
from the pinpoint.
Yeah, little half scoop, yeah.
Chris, how about you?
So I said earlier, I work part-time in for King County, and I was downtown for the event. And what struck me was, for about a half hour, it was a big party out in the street. Most employers, including King County, let their workers go outside, and people were sharing the sunglasses. People had made those boxes you could look through. People had food. And it was a little community party there watching the eclipse. And, of course, it was awesome to see. It was worth remembering.
Yeah, a little bit of shared humanity there.
Yeah,
right?
That was
a moment
a pretty
to
great
all
moment.
To be together.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And to remember how small we are. Right?
Thanks to Joni Balter and Chris Vance and Mike McGinn for joining us on The Week in Review. Coming up Monday on the program, we're going to revisit that topic we talked about a little bit earlier about Amazon and its impact on the city. Amina Al-Saadi produced our program. Jeannie Yandel edited it. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Ross Reynolds. Thanks for listening.